This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Broadcasting from the state-of-the-art L-shaped studios at beautiful and serene Ho-Ho Loon Plaza in Vancouver, British Columbia, Greg Phillips and Nick Toop are the hard-traveling fanhound.
When you hear this show, you better run for cover.
Nick, I'm getting in the wrestling business.
Boy, let me tell you something. I'm about to get me in the damn movie business. Woo!
Welcome to the latest edition of the longest running weekly
episodic comic book podcast in all
of Place to Be Nation. And perhaps the longest running weekly episodic comic book podcast in the entire sports entertainment industry. We are here this week with another edition of the Long Book Hunters.
Indeed.
One of our longest running and weekly episode, one of our longest running features here in the Hard Traveling Fanboys, one that goes all the way back to the beginning. And this is, of course, where we take a look at a trade paperback or graphic novel in the comic book world and give it a review right here on our airwaves. And this time around, we're doing something that we've never done before. Every time that we get a chance, we like to sort of cross the streams, if you will, of our pop culture interests. Nick and I are huge comic book fans. But we're also huge fans of professional wrestling.
And we like it, you know, when professional wrestling can be taken and adapted into other media, like comic books or
right,
you know, maybe like a little motion picture film. We'll talkie, as they used to call them back in the day.
I agree. I really, you know, some of those films would be something like Beyond the Mat, something like The Wrestler by Darren Aronofsky, or my personal favorite and the best of them all, Hitman Hart Wrestling with Shadows.
Oh, there you go. There you go. That's a good one. But, you know, who knows what the future may hold in wrestling-related media?
Yes, who knows indeed. And I think anyone that knows Nick knows that right now we're pretty much just on a countdown to see when the ball's going to drop here and when Nick's crotchal region is going to expose itself on the show here due to certain recent announcements. But
this,
I have no control over
of the hard
Nick
traveling
to fanboys talk about this
comes to you on this, the greatest day in the history of not just our sport, but of our species. I would argue this is a monumental day in human history. We are all lucky and privileged to live in this era, in my opinion.
Bold words from a bold man, Captain Insano. Now, what we are actually here to talk about, and I'm sure that we'll talk about other things in this, is the rare aligning of the stars in our pop culture world where comics and wrestling cross over with one another. Once in a blue moon, we get to do a show like this, and this is no different because we – in this case, are here to talk about the Boom Studios WWE comic book. In particular, the first trade paperback collection of WWE, which is simply titled WWE Volume 1, Redesign, Rebuild, Reclaim. And this little series got kicked off. I'm trying to find out exactly what the year was. 2017, it looks like, they kicked off this series of WWE comic books. And at least that's when the trade is dated. So over the years, Nick, wrestling and comic books have had, wouldn't you say, a somewhat complex relationship.
A checkered past, if you will. Yeah. As someone who has not read Headlocked, let me get that out. That's the one caveat. And
which we have had scheduled for an eternity, but haven't gotten around to yet.
I would call it a major caveat, but I think even you, as someone who's read it and is a fan of the book, would acknowledge it's a relatively niche product still, correct?
Yes. I contributed to a Kickstarter actually for Headlocked and very much enjoyed it, by the way. I've read it and enjoyed it. We're going to get around to it at some point here, but it's certainly a niche product. It's got a very small audience. It's mm-hmm. not available, you know, nationwide certainly.
So with that one NBA mid-level exception of Headlocked, by and large, the history of wrestling-related comic books is not good, to put it kindly. Most notably, there was a WCW comic that was actually published by Marvel in the early to mid-90s that, wasn't good.
Somewhat unique, if you will.
Okay. And then you've also got various attempts by WWE over the years to publish comics, whether it be a short-lived attempt at a Warrior comic book during his brief return to the company in 1996,
yep,
or whether it be a series of WWF miniseries during the height of the Attitude Era, focusing on characters such as
The Undertaker,
The Rock, Mankind, China. All the you know, big names of that era, really. So altogether, the history of wrestling in comics, again, is not a good one. I would go so far as to say, in terms of a licensed comic, I have never read one that was good. I have read ones that were so bad they were enjoyable, but none that were good on a basic level.
A good example of one that was so bad that it was enjoyable was The Rock number one, which I actually have.
Undertaker number one is the same. Yes.
Yeah, where it's like it is just an abysmally bad comic book where they – and the general approach to wrestling comics has always been pro wrestling itself is real. Everything you see on screen is the real thing. Yes. These characters are real. And it's taking these characters and their backstories and putting them in even more outlandish real lives where The Undertaker is actually a demon wizard who has an evil brother, Kane, who's also a demon wizard.
And they are fighting over the Book of the Dead, and Paul Bearer is pitting the two against one another in an attempt to distract them both so that he can claim the Book of the Dead. And somehow Mankind plays into all this. Why? I don't know.
The Rock goes to Las Vegas on a seemingly routine weekend to play blackjack and ends up – and he speaks only in Rock promos. So he's not capable of simply, hey, I would like a beer. It is The Rock says, why don't you get a beer, shine it up real nice, and bring it over to The Rock's table. And it's the whole comic book full of that, which can be kind of funny, actually. But on the other hand, it also involves a secret government agency trying to abduct The Rock. And, just outlandish things like this. And these are almost invariably stupid and bad. And then sometimes just dreadfully boring. And don't forget, there was also a Kevin Nash licensed comic.
Oh God!
For a while, it had Kevin Nash as a supernatural warrior.
I am looking at right now a panel from Undertaker number one that reveals the true parentage of the Undertaker, and it appears to be that some sort of cult group has kidnapped the Undertaker's mother and tied her to a bed. And here comes fat, naked Paul Bearer, looking not unlike the Allfather.
Just a minute.
Looking not unlike the Allfather from Preacher, with his gut, and moving towards her with the intention of, well, forcing himself upon her. So these are the sorts of things that you could see in WWF comics back in like circa 1998, 1999.
Hold on. Wikipedia claims to have a list of comics in wrestling, or comic book-based wrestling series. Okay, we've got WWF Battle Mania from Valiant Comics, mm-hmm. World Championship Wrestling from Marvel Comics, Undertaker, Mankind, Stone Cold Steve Austin, China, China 2 and The Rock from Chaos Comics. 10th Muse, based on the life of Rena Mero, a.k.a. Sable, from Image Comics. Nash, based on Kevin Nash, also from Image Comics. I had no idea the Nash series was Image. Warrior, from Warrior Productions. And Lucha Underground, apparently, as a comic as well, which actually might be good. But well, anyway, the point we're trying
some
to...
Some level of sense. You know,
the point we're trying to make here is historically it's been bad and bordering on awful. But fast forward to 2017 and the Marvel Comics writer Dennis Hopeless, which is an awesome name, Nick, wouldn't you agree?
Either an awesome name or just a depressing name. How would you like to be named Hopeless?
Well, don't we all feel that way most of the time? Oh my gosh, that was morbidly obese.
Like Paul Bearer in the Undertaker comic.
Yes, morbidly obese. Anyway,
or like Yokozuna, who of course will be body slammed in the closing moments of the sequel to an as of yet unreleased film starring and featuring certain actors as certain greatest professional wrestlers of all time.
I would remind you that that will not be the focus of said movie.
The sequel, again, may I remind you, because inevitably, you know, if you're only telling part of this, you know, 30-year story, you're leaving the door open for sequels. To me, I'm envisioning this thing at least 5 movies, but I could really see 12 to 15 by the time we're all said and done. Mm-hmm. Truly the next great franchise in film history is about to be launched, and I, for one, can't wait.
Well, hopefully at some point in the show, folks, we'll figure out exactly what movie Nick's talking about. But for now, this comment came to us from Dennis Hopeless with art from Dan Mora, who illustrated the prologue, and Serge Acuna, who actually illustrated the chapters, which is essentially 4 comics along with a prologue, which was a shorter comic, collected together, the redesign, rebuild, reclaim, as we mentioned. And what this comic purported to do, this series purported to do when it launched, was to tell in-continuity stories about the WWE characters. In other words, to sort of take real-life stories from Raw or SmackDown or whatever the shows may have been, or pre-brand split, the entire company, take those stories and sort of fill in the blanks, right? To take these characters and tell us stories that would fit with the stories that we saw on camera, on TV. And both Nick and I, when this launched, actually thought that's kind of a compelling way to do this. Yes. If you're not going to approach it like Headlocked, which approaches sort of the real-life sort of backstage maneuvering of being a professional wrestler, and treats it as an art form rather than, you know, reality. If you're going to approach it from the kayfabe perspective about pro wrestling, that's about as good a way to do it as I can think of, because you're putting these – you're not having John Cena as an astronaut, or, you know, you're not having, I don't know, Roman Reigns as an army soldier or something. You're not having Bray Wyatt as a truck driver. Never mind. But for the most part, this is about filling in those stories in ways that you could theoretically imagine these characters engaging in real life if the characters were the real life personas.
Right. Yeah, that's a pretty good way of summing it up. I think the one flaw in that is that to do it, you have to pretend like these characters are the characters 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And as we'll discuss, I think that starts to kind of have some cracks in the armor as we go along here.
Yes, and partly that has cracks in the armor because there are so few distinctive characters nowadays, if you really think about it. One of the things that this kind of exposes is the limited number of unique voices, because so many of the wrestlers walk, talk, and act the same. And while there are subtle differences that you can pick up if you watch the show every week, it's kind of hard to put that across in text form versus putting it across. You know, if you heard AJ Styles talk, you would know it's AJ Styles. But if you just read his words on a page, it could be coming from damn near anyone.
Except for the fact that they have him drop the G's off words to signify his southern accent in this comic.
His southern accent. That's true. And I will say that right out of the gates. I mean, let's get cracking on this. I mean, right out of the gates, I think Dennis Hopeless, the writer, does a pretty damn good job of capturing the voices of these wrestlers. Mm-hmm. While there aren't very many spotlighted here, and someone like a Roman Reigns or a Seth Rollins or Dean Ambrose don't necessarily always have the most distinctive voices in terms of writing, he does a good job of writing these characters in recognizable ways, because I was actually able to hear this dialogue in each of the characters' voices, which goes a long way, because a lot of writers, I'm sure, would have written this, and I would never have been able to in a million years imagine Seth Rollins saying something that they wrote here or something, you know? So
right.
In that regard, I think that's one way where this comic book gets off on a good note is across the entire comic, really, I don't really have any issues where I could not ever imagine that wrestler saying that, or at least none that pop out in my mind, Nick.
Yeah, I would tend to agree. I think the one glaring example, though, that kind of flies in the face of that argument is Dean Ambrose in this comic.
Mm-hmm.
Listen, there's no real way. WWE themselves have struggled with making the comedic, wacky version of Dean Ambrose interesting or compelling in any sort of way.
Right.
And so to take that and even go a step below it is not great. You have Dean Ambrose cutting promos about potato salad. You have Dean Ambrose shirtlessly cooking steaks on top of a WWE production truck. You've got Dean Ambrose stealing a WWE production truck so he can go get potato salad. You've got Dean Ambrose seemingly punking out Seth Rollins backstage repeatedly over the course of like an entire year, despite the fact that technically Seth Rollins is supposed to be your point of view character in this book, and thus makes him look kind of like a bitch.
You've also got Dean Ambrose in his quest to get potato salad almost committing vehicular homicide by running over Bray Wyatt.
Yeah, he tries to kill the Wyatts with a WWE production truck.
So, yeah, that's true. However, my counter to that would be, could you not hear the shitty WWE comedy version of Dean Ambrose saying some of these things or having this reaction to things? Perhaps it was extreme, granted, but we also watched Dean Ambrose bring a mustard cart to the ring and squirt his opponents with mustard. So, I don't know, in some degree, in some ways I could see it, but yeah, I mean, those were pretty stupid scenes. And the premise of this comic, I guess I should mention that. I'm not going to go plot point by plot point, but the idea of this is, as you mentioned, Seth Rollins is our point of view character. And it picks up the week before the Shield split in 2014 and shows us what's going through Seth Rollins' mind that whole week leading into, what was that pay-per-view event, Nick? Was that
Battleground?
No, I thought the one where they wrestled Evolution.
Was it not Battleground?
I don't think so. I think it was Payback. I believe it was called Payback, but I can find out.
Payback, yes.
So in leading into Payback and kind of telling us what his thoughts are like that week and what he's going through that week and what kind of leads us to the decision that he makes on Monday Night Raw the night after Payback to turn on the Shield. Which, for those of you who aren't wrestling fans, that the split of the Shield and the Shield storyline in general is probably the best piece of original storytelling or the best original invention, rather, that WWE has had in a long, long time. I mean, that whole storyline where they came in 2012 and built up to the most dominant stable in perhaps in WWE history – was a great time in the company, honestly. This was one of the recent creative peaks of the company. It was a great example, a rare great example of building original characters up from the ground and making them believable as main eventers. And so this story picks us up the night that Seth Rollins turns on the Shield, which was a huge moment, a controversial moment, and one that, you know, people still debate today of whether it should have happened or not. And it goes from that night and carries us through the next, what, Nick, year and a half of Seth Rollins' life as he builds himself up into a world champion, wins the world championship, defends it for several months, and then gets injured in a match, a house show match against Kane, and then has to sort of build his way back up, rebuild, redesign, reclaim, and come back to Raw as the rebuilt version of Seth Rollins, and once again pursue the WWE Championship. And it, most importantly, and I think most compellingly, would you agree, Nick, explores the relationship between the Seth Rollins character and the Triple H character over the course of this period of time.
Yes, it absolutely does, including portraying Triple H as, like, essentially the Emperor Palpatine of the WWE yep. universe, where he is just always looming in the background and everyone pretty much stays out of his way, including numerous scenes where he pretty much emasculates Seth Rollins, you know, and there's nothing really Seth can do about it. Even by the end, Seth doesn't really get any kind of comeuppance on Triple H, but again, no. This is having to reflect real-life WWE storytelling for the most part. So perhaps that was followed up on at a later date? I don't know.
Yes. Presumably, as we know in real life, the storyline went when Rollins came back, he was still a bad guy. And he comes back and he is aligned with Triple H, but they're not really closely aligned anymore. And then at a certain point, Triple H turns on Rollins and it leads to their match at WrestleMania the next year, where Rollins was able to become the Kingslayer, defeating Triple H. And we were there too. Mm-hmm. And the, that usage of Triple H as the Emperor is a great comparison, Nick, because it's probably my favorite version of Triple H I've ever encountered, I have to say. Because I've always thought that he's at his best as a heel, as opposed to, say, this past Monday night on Raw. But I always have thought he's at his best as a heel. And at his best when he really embraces being the bad guy and doesn't try to be the cool bad guy. And what we see here is the story that they're telling is Roman and Dean, you know, telling Seth that it's not worth it what he sacrificed to become the champion, to become the man. It wasn't worth selling out. And you start to see that over the course of this story building in Seth Rollins of how slowly he realizes what it means to be Triple H's pawn. Because as you put it, Nick, Triple H completely emasculates him throughout this entire book, at every turn. Every time Seth wants to do something, Triple H tells him no. Or Triple H tells him when to go where, when to eat, when to work out, when to wrestle, what to do, what not to do. And if Seth steps out of line even slightly, Triple H immediately smacks him down and controls him. I love this version of Triple H. We were talking about this off the air, Nick. I wish that Triple H played this version of his character all the time on air. Mm-hmm. And even though we're all kind of done, I think, with authority storylines for a while, that's one way that I think I could get behind it more, because it's such a, you know, if he was more of a lurking presence in the background rather than out there front every single week cutting promos. And when he does show up, it's to be this weaselly, you know, domineering evil figure. I thought that part of the story was by far the best and was really compelling. What about you, Nick?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Triple H was, you know, he was, like you said, the most compelling part of the story, because he played really the only effective villain that there is. Because in the storyline of the Shield breaking up, it's interesting that you choose to go with Seth Rollins as your initial point of view character, because he's the villain. Mm-hmm. We should, you know, ideally you would think that you would be looking at the breakup of the Shield from the perspective of Dean or Roman, with Seth as the main villain, but you go a different approach. So you have to have somebody else step into that main antagonistic role, which is where you use Triple H to great effect for the most part. There are some aspects of Triple H's character, as much as I appreciated them, that we'll talk about, where, like, you know, this comic, like we said earlier, one of the cracks in its armor is that it takes that idea of these people being their real-life personas to an almost comedic degree, to the point where Triple H is this multi-millionaire hotshot who hangs out at the Savannah, Georgia Yacht Club, which I'm pretty sure is not even a thing, by the way. Or
with a bunch of rich people.
With a bunch of rich people, or who owns his own yacht named, go ahead, Greg.
The Cerebral Assassin. C is in Catwoman. But come on, Nick, be honest. Do you not wish that Triple H owned a yacht in real life called the Cerebral Assassin?
Oh, that would be awesome. But there are other examples, too, like the Wyatts being a literal cult all the time. You know?
The Wyatt stuff was so ridiculous because, first of all, why are they driving monster trucks?
Well, that's their...
Why do the Wyatts have their own personal monster truck?
Well, they got one. I don't know.
They got one, and they chase after Dean Ambrose, who drives the WWE production truck through a building at one point.
Because he's got to get tater salad.
And kicks off a brawl with the Wyatts, which Seth Rollins manages to end on his own, saving his brothers in the Shield, but further building his feeling that he needs to go out on his own. And, That was rather silly. The constant Dean Ambrose gag that I didn't like either, with him constantly punking out Seth in public locations, as you pointed out. There was a pretty funny gag about Roman Reigns in there. Did you catch it, Nick? Where he Roman comes up and tells a horrible joke to confront Seth, and Seth calls him out on what a bad joke it was.
Yes.
And that was pretty funny for people that have followed Roman's on-air character, who he was often scripted to tell just terribly cheesy dialogue, such as I think the what was the famous one, Suffering Sassafras.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so that was good, but yeah, and as the comic goes on, we get a cameo by the New Day. What did you make of the New Day chapter?
That was very interesting. Again, you know, these on-air characters act like this in real life is the premise of this comic book. So the New Day break into Seth Rollins' apartment in full New Day attire, you know, trunks and unicorn horns and Francesca twos or whatever Francesca we were on at this point, to cheer an injured Seth Rollins up using the power of positivity. And this comic, if we take it as WWE canon, reveals that Seth Rollins is responsible for the creation of Bootios.
Of Bootios.
They make sure you ain't booty.
That's right. I actually really liked the New Day part, and it was probably almost as outlandish as the Wyatt's portion, which I didn't like.
Yes.
But something about the New Day works in an over-the-top setting, particularly the writing of their dialogue was really strong, I thought. And the idea of them breaking into Seth Rollins' apartment while he's got a busted leg, to quote Colonel Rob Parker, and just kind of having their way with his apartment without him being able to do anything because he's injured, that was pretty awesome. I thought anyway. I thought it was funny and enjoyable and a nice little distraction from what at times becomes a little repetitive, because there's a lot of Seth Rollins' inner monologue talking about his recovery, talking about how much he doesn't care about the fans anymore and how much he doesn't care about Seth and Dean or Roman and Dean. But overall, that was the other aspect of this. Did it feel a little uneven to you in a pacing standpoint? Because it felt like just when I was starting to dig into the Seth and Triple H stuff,
yes,
suddenly we're flashing to Seth in his apartment, or suddenly we're flashing to Seth at the trainer's office, or the trainer's room, even not trainer's office.
Yeah, because the pacing of it was a little weird, because as we know, the Seth Rollins story is one that plays out, like you just said, over the course of like a year and a half, which is fine. I mean, that's a great, you know, if you're telling this particular story. And I think it's roughly 5 issues worth of page count, technically 4, but there was a double-sized issue in there. And anyway, but it's roughly 5 issues of page count, so you would think you're going to cover 2 to 3 months of story in each issue. Instead, what you kind of get is there are moments where it slows down and, like, will take an entire, you know, take multiple pages on like, you know, a 1 to 2 day span. And then there are times where it skips big chunks of time. Because it really felt to me like, I don't know if you felt this way or not, once he won the title, you know, at WrestleMania 31, it felt like it very quickly jumped from there to injuring himself. When in reality, we know it was like 6 months or however long later.
Yeah, because they actually, it's almost, I'm looking at it right now, it's almost a sequence of pages where it's each page is a different title defense. Mm-hmm. And there's the only one they really focus on is the Brock Lesnar title defense. Mm-hmm. After he gets through Brock Lesnar, which they don't even show on here, but after the Brock Lesnar match, there's, you know, he has a backstage fight with Roman Reigns. And then from there, it's like April, Extreme Rules, main event. May, Payback, main event. June, Money in the Bank, main event. Well, it's building to the Lesnar rematch. And then, then it acts like after the Lesnar rematch, there was nothing else left for Seth. It skips SummerSlam. It skips all that stuff. His feud with John Cena, which was a big part of that year. And then he's injured. Mm-hmm. And there's a cool part where they show him on the operating table and it flashes back to when he's a kid. So there's a lot of good stuff here, I think, that adds depth to the Seth Rollins story of that era, which was a pretty well-told story, all things considered, when you factor in the injury and everything. Mm-hmm. But I also felt, and I don't know how you feel about this, I feel like they probably should have pursued this story to its natural conclusion through WrestleMania of that year with him and Triple H. Because I keep waiting for the turn for the split to happen and with him and Triple H, and we never really get the full payoff of that.
And I think the reason that because they're trying to keep the narrative on the Shield themselves, the next arc of this book jumps to Dean Ambrose, because if you remember correctly, that Seth Rollins' return ultimately winds up in WWE champion Dean Ambrose finally getting some measure of revenge against Seth Rollins by cashing in the briefcase on him at whatever – was it Battleground? I don't remember.
Something like that, yeah.
Money in the Bank? I don't – you know what I'm saying.
One of those pay-per-views, yeah.
So you jump perspectives for the next arc because you're trying to tell the next installment of this Shield-related story.
Right, that's true. Yep. It's just
I wonder, subsequent volumes, do they ever actually pay off the Seth and Triple H thing? Or are they trying for the comic purposes to keep the narrative strictly on the Shield?
Yeah, that very well could be. But I guess from my point of view, I felt like the thematic story that's being told here, if you disqualify the fact that they're telling a Shield story, the hook here really wasn't the Shield
because I agree.
Dean and Roman aren't really in it that much. It's Seth and Triple H and their relationship and how Triple H converts him to the dark side, so to speak. And we never really see Seth come out the other side because even at the end of this book, he's still on the dark side. He's just not taking orders from Triple H anymore. Mm-hmm. So anyway, but that being said, we've kind of talked about the writing aspect of this book and the character, the dialogue, which I thought was mostly good. The dialogue, there are a couple of moments here and there where it's heavy handed, but frankly, you get used to that if you watch Monday Night Raw every week as we do.
Right.
So,
we are more into, I think like we said, whenever we first heard about this and like the approach it was going to take, we were up for the concept to a degree that we kind of knew. I mean, let's be honest, like, top-level creators are not going to go write a WWE comic, for the most part.
Right.
Yes, you have wrestling fans who are comic book creators. I'm not saying that. But they are paid much better than probably than Dennis Hopeless is. They probably are getting much better offers to do interesting creative projects than Dennis Hopeless is. The execution was only ever going to be so good. But I think the concept here is interesting enough that you can forgive some of the hiccups in execution along the way.
Right. And I think that of all of the WWE affiliated comic books I've read, Dennis Hopeless is the only writer that I've ever read that really did a good job of capturing the on-air characters in a believable manner. I mean, yes, to the degree that The Rock was cutting Rock promos in his comic, but it never felt like it was converted into a real world scenario. It almost felt like you were cutting and pasting from, you know, The Rock insulting D'Lo Brown or Kane and kind of just pasting it into him insulting blackjack dealers. This felt more organic, like these wrestlers could be in these roles. Particularly, he did a good job, I think, of writing Seth Rollins in this, who is our point of view character. Let's talk about the art, because there's two different artists on here. Dan Mora on the prologue and Serge Acuna on the Acuna, on the bulk of the book. And both have kind of similar styles, I think I would say, Nick. Very, I think, kind of a cartoony approach to drawing, perhaps. And some of the characters look very much like their real life selves. I would say, I would actually say most of them don't, but a few of them do. And primarily, I think of all these characters, Triple H is really the one to me that looks, maybe Bray Wyatt as well, but Triple H is the one that looks, and Harper, I'm looking at an image of Harper and it's perfect, but Triple H for some reason looks like a photographed version of himself from television. And the rest of the guys look sort of, in my opinion, not much like their real life personas.
Yeah, I would tend to agree. The art is a little cartoony for my taste, especially considering you're trying to literally portray something that we see in real life every single week. So mm-hmm. I would have thought a more realistic approach probably would have been better. But, you know, WWE storytelling is often cartoonish and over the top. So I suppose it fits in a certain regard.
Yes, and it's weird because I think Mora did a better job of distinguishing the Shield guys and making them look realistic, but Acuna does a better job with some of his actual sequences here. In particular, I think actually the best artistic sequence in the book might be the very opening page of chapter one, which is Seth Rollins climbing the ladder to reach the Money in the Bank briefcase. I say that because there's one panel on here in particular, he's climbing this ladder, where it shows a close-up of Seth's eyes as the Money in the Bank briefcase reflects in his eyes and just shows how almost like Gollum going for the ring, you know, and that it's consumed his life basically to grab this briefcase and this spot at the top. I think there's actually some really good sequences from that standpoint on here. That's probably my favorite in the entire book, though. I think where it struggles are in some of the wrestling sequences. I don't think are exceptionally well done.
No comic has ever done wrestling sequences well.
Yes. No, never. I've never, ever seen one that got wrestling sequences in a believable.
It's very difficult to do because so much of wrestling is in the fluidity and the motion, and it's very difficult to do that with still images.
Sorry. I'm looking at this image of Seth Rollins running into Triple H backstage at WrestleMania 32 after Rollins has lost to Randy Orton, and Triple H is standing there in his wrestling trunks holding a sledgehammer in one hand and a giant turkey leg in the other hand.
Well, he's getting his protein in to go whoop Sting's ass and prove once and for all the superiority of WWF compared to WCW.
There's nothing good about that. Also, kudos to Acuna for illustrating Shawn Michaels with his flannel shirt, blue jeans tucked into cowboy boots look.
Yes, it is an accurate modern era Shawn Michaels look.
So anyway, overall thoughts on this one, Nick. To me, it's a little bit of a mixed bag. Mm-hmm. The art is a little cartoony for my taste, but I can't knock it too much. He does Triple H really well. And there's some good sequences in there. The writing is mostly good for a wrestling comic. I would give this a slight thumbs up. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on
that? I would tend to agree. Like, it clears that ever so low bar of being the best wrestling comic I've read. But again, that bar is extremely low. I would say if you have to score it, like you're saying, a slight thumbs up. So if five is in the middle, I'll go six, and I think that's pretty generous. But I think, yeah, again, compared, if this is a six, most other wrestling comics are ones and twos. It's ones and twos. It really is that much better than any other wrestling comic I've read.
I would agree with that. It's not as good as Headlocked. Headlocked is still my favorite wrestling comic,
right?
But it's kind of a different beast. This is trying to do something else. And both of you, we talked about this off the air as well, Nick. We both think that this is the right avenue. If you're going to write an in canon character based story in WWE, this is much closer to the right path of what you need to go on if you're going to do that, right?
Right. Don't try to tell unique stories. Don't try to tell your own storyline. You know, try to provide additional context to what we've seen, because if it's in continuity with these characters in canon, then there's no way you can do original stories, which that's the number one thing that never made any sense. Like with the WCW comic, for example, when are these things supposed to be taking place in between all these other TV shows we're watching? You know,
yeah. Or in other cases, when has John Cena gone to NASA to learn how to become an astronaut?
Well, he has a doctorate in thugonomics, which apparently is equitable to a doctorate in astrophysics.
What they never told us when he premiered in 2002 is that he had actually already been to thugonomics school for 6 years to get training to become the doctor of thugonomics, and then he just started wrestling. But yeah, it's interesting how
Scott Steiner is about to make a guest appearance, folks, on the Hard Traveling Fanboys.
If only. If only. Just imagine how great it would be if we had Scott Steiner on here.
It would actually be very bad for us. I don't think he would be too kind of people like us.
It could just be him yelling at us for being fat for an hour and a half.
Fat son of a bitch.
That fat son of a bitch, Nick Duke, and his even fatter friend Greg Phillips. Son of bitches. But yeah, so overall, I think this is the right track to go on. And while I don't think that that this necessarily 100% fulfills it, I think that it's heading in the right direction. And to your point, Nick, I think if you're going to tell your original stories, the only way to do it is something like a what if kind of comic book related to wrestling.
Oh, now listen to what you're doing there. Telling tales out of skewl, quite frankly.
Out of skewl. That's right. That would be a way to approach it. But anyway, so overall, slight thumbs up if you're a wrestling fan. If you're not a wrestling fan, don't read this. There's no reason for you to ever read this.
No, I mean, let's be honest. By comic book standards, it's not. It is okay. It is barely passable. It's not that great. And if you're not a wrestling fan, it's not even going to hit that level for you. So,
right.
Honestly, a large part of our enjoyment of it is probably because our expectations. I don't know about you. My expectations coming to this were as low as they possibly could be.
Yes. The wasn't there also a WWE comic that was before this that was written by Mick Foley that had a very short run?
Yes, published by Paper Cut Studios, and that was the one that featured John Cena and everybody as different characters in addition to their wrestling personas.
Well, yeah, if you are a wrestling fan, I would say – you know, this trade is available on Hoopla, which you can get through your local library. In most
possibly.
Places,
it depends, or, it depends if your library is a partner or not. But
right. Know. If you can get a hold of it to read, I would give it a shot. Yeah. I wouldn't recommend going out of your way for it. But if you are a big wrestling fan, maybe buy this. I don't think it's that much money as a trade. And give it a read. And you know, maybe you'll find some enjoyment in it. We definitely found some enjoyment in this one. So that's pretty much my thoughts on it. So
perhaps we'll check back in on future volumes at some point.
Right. And with that being said, we are going to take a break-a-rooney, which is not like the spin-a-rooney. And we're going to come back after the break.
Chris Hemsworth, we're coming for you.
We're coming back with our usual segments, reading, watching, and the rundown.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Place for Nation's Justin Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceForNation.com. And we now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the PlaceForNation Wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, Main Event, Survey Says, Wrestling War Zone, a Monday Night Wars podcast retrospective, No Holds Barred, Jeff Learns Wrestling, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows. On top of that, we're also dipping into the vault, re-releasing the entire catalog of Where the Big Boys Play for your enjoyment. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver special network pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation pop feed is loaded with great content, offering such tremendous shows covering the land of pop culture, such as Geek and Sassy, Talkin' Pop, the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Sunday Groove, PTB In Play, Freak Out Drive-In, Songs with Friends, Looking Forward, Looking Back, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Conversation Comics, DC Post Crisis Management, Marvel Age, and Marvel Age Masterclass, plus weekly pod blasts that cover the gamut of comic topics. The feed is also filled with insightful sports content, including the NBA team, This Week in the NFL, and more.
And you can find all these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows plus others available at PlaySpeedNation.com. We cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, in-depth stretch projects, and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlaySpeedNation.com/Amazon while doing your online shopping. And download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaySpeedNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome back, folks, to the show. We are back with our usual stuff. And I should mention that we are coming to you from the L-Shaped Studio in Hoholoon Plaza in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, which is both beautiful and serene. Nick, how are you enjoying this fine Vancouver day?
Oh, it's a wonderful day here in Vancouver, here in Canada, the site of numerous notable events throughout both human history and the industry of professional wrestling. Notably, I think a certain WrestleMania that took place at the Sky Dome in 2002 that will, of course, be featured in the climax to the fourth film in the soon-to-be-ongoing wrestling cinematic universe that will be launching here in the coming years. So
the climax of the fourth film. So
absolutely.
I mean, so what is the time frame exactly on this fourth film?
Probably not the climax, actually, now that I think about it. It would be like right before the climax, because there's only one way to end that one, right? You know, you got to end that one at the Kemper Arena in St. Louis, Missouri, for a little backlash action.
No, I think you got to end that one in whatever arena that young Nick Duke was at when Mr. America took the lie detector test.
Now see, we're not making Mr. America movies here, Greg. We're making movies featuring unnamed actors playing unnamed professional wrestlers.
And also, how would you classify the other major event that took place at the Sky Dome involving unnamed professional wrestlers?
They were both landmark moments in the history of the business.
Well, you seem to give one preferential treatment over the other.
No. The other one, don't worry. The other one will be depicted as well in the second film in this universe, but it'll be depicted fairly early on, you know, as our hero will have cause to doubt himself, and he'll have to go on the journey of making the great comeback to, of course, you know, do what certain other individuals, quite frankly, couldn't
do. We're moving on now by showing up
to WrestleMania 9 in Las Vegas, Nevada, and defeating the nefarious Yokozuna.
Where we look at the news and notes in the world of comics. It's a segment we like to call The Rundown. Expected announcement, not like the bombshell movie announcement, but an expected announcement that Netflix, which of course is a popular streaming service, enjoyed as I understand it by some people, has decided to cancel both The Punisher and Jessica Jones, this according to Deadline. The recently filmed third season of Jessica Jones is still expected to air on the streaming service later this year. However, the company has preemptively canceled any intention of subsequent seasons. The Punisher, of course, with showrunner Gordon Lightfoot, has been very well received by many. But Jessica Jones in particular probably stands as a critical darling in the Netflix universe. Nick, your thoughts on these cancellations? Not a surprise at all.
Not a surprise. In the case of Jessica Jones, especially, I remember there was some speculation even before Netflix started to cancel the Marvel shows that one might come to an end after season three. Because if you remember, showrunner Melissa Rosenberg had signed an exclusive production deal with Warner Brothers and was going to be leaving the Netflix Jessica Jones property anyway at the conclusion of this season. So, not surprising on any regard. But I would like to point out Jeff Loeb once the final cancellations of the last two shows came down, did issue an official statement in his role as head of Marvel Television, and said that essentially said something to the effect of the story of the incarnation of these are incarnations of these characters is not yet over, so stay tuned. So I don't want to read too much into it, you know, and say it's certainly happening, but I think there's at least a chance we'll see some, if not all, of these shows back somewhere else at some point.
One of the actors, actually, from Daredevil mentioned that the actors are under contract saying they can't appear as those characters for something like 18 months after the cancellation date. So.
That is accurate, but in the case of something like Iron Fist, you're going to be hitting that if it's actually if you can't appear, that doesn't mean I don't think you can't be in production on something that would not premiere until after. And also, let's be honest, if Disney really wanted to, if they cared enough, they could just pay Netflix a chunk of change and be like, hey, can we get out of that? Here's some money. You know, not saying that's going to happen, but there are always ways around these sorts of things.
Well, speaking of Melissa Rosenberg, Nick, what were your thoughts on Bill Goldberg winning the WCW World Heavyweight Championship in the Georgia Dome in 1998?
You know, obviously a very important part that will be featured in the third film in our franchise. You know, the third film in our franchise is going to be a little interesting because normally the second film will be where you have the down ending, you know, that kind of leads to the redemptive story in the third movie. But in our franchise, three movies is just not enough real estate to tell this story with the, you know, pomp and circumstance that it deserves. And so our franchise, being that it's going to be extended beyond just three movies, the third movie will actually end on a down ending. That'll be featured there. Of course, we'll have the nefarious events of Bash at the Beach 2000 that will be featured and set us up for the grand return to glory in the aforementioned fourth film.
We're just going to have to solve the eternal riddle, though, in that third movie of who plays Billy Kidman.
Billy Kidman will, of course, be played by a 12-year-old.
And also important, who plays our beloved
Chandler? Chandler Riggs will play Billy Kidman.
Oh, I like that. That's not bad. Chandler Riggs is Billy Kidman. I like that. Mm-hmm. Now, who plays Vince Russo?
Oh, Vince Russo will be played by... Let me think. I'd have to really think on it. Vince Russo.
Jerry Seinfeld.
Vince Russo will be played by the he should turn himself in guy from The Dark Knight.
Here's what we're going to do. So, nobody with a southern accent ever got over, brother. Anyway, but while Marvel Television taketh away, Marvel Television also giveth. And in this case, the planned Disney Plus service is going to be having several Marvel TV shows, one of which is based on Loki, Thor's brother, played by Tom Hiddleston. And this week we found that Rick and Morty's Michael Waldron has been tapped as showrunner for the show, which is what you would expect a showrunner to do as a show. And the premise will reveal how Loki has been an unlikely influencer on historical events as he pops up throughout human history. Now, you can correct me if you find this to be a wrong interpretation, but it basically sounds like a Loki version of Legends of Tomorrow, right?
Something like that, although I think the implication here is that so Legends of Tomorrow is all about them trying to fix time for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
And this kind of sounds like they're going to take a look at different historical events and reveal how Loki was like pulling the strings behind all of it for his own entertainment to throughout history. And that is a wonderful concept for a Loki series, in my opinion. This sounds awesome to me.
Yes, I don't know much about Rick and Morty. I don't know that I've ever seen an episode of it.
No.
But I do know that Tom Hiddleston is awesome as Loki, and I will take... And it also helps you get around the Loki is dead thing, you know, if you want to keep him dead after, you know, post Thanos. So I'm good with that. I like that premise. Excited for it. Has there been any word, Nick? I didn't see this in the article on when the series is going to debut.
No, none yet. The thought process is Disney Plus will be debuting by the end of the year. This will probably not be in the initial batch of series that launch with it, but would be probably for wave two a few months after that, I would think.
Right. Well, let's keep it on Marvel, but move away from Marvel Studios in particular and move on to the original Wolverine from back in the day. And his name, of course, was Doug Ray Scott or Doug Ray Scott, depending on how the name is pronounced. Well, that guy has now been cast by Marvel's distinguished competition in CW's Batwoman, as Doug Ray Scott will be playing the role of Colonel Kane, of course, the father of Kate Kane, a.k.a. Batwoman, Jacob Kane. He is, of course, an essential character to the Batwoman mythos.
Tell you something I didn't know about Doug Ray Scott or Doug Ray Scott. He is married to Claire Forlani.
Who?
And you, yeah, you may be saying to yourself, who? As someone who's not a massive Kevin Smith fan, she played the lead love interest in Mallrats and is hot as hell. And you can't teach that.
Thanks, Enzo.
You're welcome.
Your thoughts on Doug Ray Scott getting cast as Colonel Kane?
I'm for it. This sounds good. Hey, here's some help from YouTube here. Let's see how they do it.
Doug Ray Scott,
according to the YouTube. So,
well, there you have it, Doug Ray Scott. Now, the interesting thing is, I've never really been able to picture what would have happened if he had played Wolverine instead of Hugh Jackman. We talked about that story, I think, way back when we did the original X-Men movie along with Tim Capel. And at the time, I think it's just hard to imagine anyone other than Hugh Jackman playing this role. We all kind of agreed on that. But looking at Doug Ray Scott now, does he actually not look more like Wolverine now than he did back then?
Especially,
he looks like he's seen some shit.
Especially given the popularity of the old man Logan character over recent years.
Like, I mean, he looks old and withered. There's just no way to get around it. And honestly, that's kind of how I've always viewed Wolverine a little bit, is old and withered. And that's can see it. But anyway, I like this casting. Colonel Kane is obviously going to be one of the most essential characters on this show to get right, and he's certainly an accomplished actor. Well, speaking of Warner Brothers, let's move on to an animation announcement. We don't cover these a lot on the show, but this one is pretty unique. As many people may know, there has been a very successful Batman Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles crossover comic written by, I believe, James Tynion IV. Right, Nick?
That is correct.
In recent years. And that comic has been so successful, in fact, that now we're getting a crossover animated film. In fact, it looks to be perhaps an adaptation of the James Tynion IV and Freddie Williams II. Wow. That is an awesome creative team. James Tynion IV and Freddie Williams II.
Mm-hmm.
I hope the anchor was Bill Smith III.
Six generations of comic creating greatness.
Basically, it's like if our good friend Andrew Chandler Fraser Garner, the 45th, mm-hmm. were able to be a comic book writer.
Or if artist. Richmond Vernon were able to be a comic book writer.
Richmond Vernon.
Who I always assume was Richmond Vernon VI or something like that.
I always assumed he was related to Connor Vernon. But in any event, this is the animated film that is a partnership and part of what it says here is a new partnership with DC and Nickelodeon. Scheduled to be released on home video later this spring, so it's apparently well into development. We don't know exactly which animation studio is developing it, so we don't kind of know what style it will have. Nick, we've talked openly about how neither of us have really given a care about the Ninja Turtles in many, many years, even though we loved them as kids. But what are your thoughts on this crossover?
This is interesting, and I've heard that the comic series is good. So I'll be interested to see, you know, if it pops up, if it's a partnership between they and Nickelodeon, perhaps this will be on free TV at some point. I can give it a shot. Perhaps it'll make its way to the DC Universe app at some point. I can give it a shot. You know, I'm not opposed to watching this at some point.
Same here. The cast includes Troy Baker, who will be voicing both Batman and the Joker. Now, he's done the Joker before. So that's interesting. In fact, I think, didn't Troy Baker voice Joker on Young Justice? Am I mistaken on that? Perhaps?
I know Troy Baker voiced the Joker, I believe, in... didn't he voice the Joker
Telltale.
In Arkham Origins, I thought.
Oh, Origins. Yep. That's right. He will be joined by Darren Criss as Raphael, Kyle Mooney as Michelangelo, Baron Vaughn as Donatello, Eric Bauza as Leonardo, Rachel Bloom as Batgirl, Tom Kenny as the Penguin, John DiMaggio, a.k.a. Bender, as Mr. Freeze, Tara Strong as both Harley Quinn and Poison Ivy. Interesting. Carlos Alzraki as Bane, and Cass Anvar as Ra's al Ghul.
Okay, Troy Baker has voiced Robin and Two-Face in Batman Arkham City, Two-Face and Batman in Lego Batman 2, the Joker in Arkham Origins, and the animated feature Batman Assault on Arkham. He reprised his role as Two-Face and voiced Jason Todd in Batman Arkham Knight, and he also voices Batman and Thomas Wayne in Batman the Telltale series.
There we go. There we have it. Well, let's move on from good old-fashioned animation. Let's get back to what butters our bread, Nick. The printed word. Print comics. Mm. The most successful industry in the world.
And if you thought that we were going to combat the allegations that we are pro-DC with this comic book news, well, we're not.
Or are we? Because kicking things off is DC's, what says here on this Newsarama article, Nick, is a year-long initiative called Year of the Villain. It will be kicking off with an event titled Year of the Villain, according to the Hollywood Reporter. On May 1, the publisher will release a special 25-cent one-shot anthology with stories about villains tying into upcoming Batman, Justice League, and Superman titles, including the City of Bane story arc in Tom King's Batman, and a continuation of the current Batman Who Laughs limited series into a new title launching this summer, Nick. Let's see. Writers Brian Michael Bendis, Scott Snyder, and James Tynion IV will be working with artists Alex Maleev, Jim Cheung, and Francis Manapul on stories for this. Greg Capullo has drawn the primary cover. The Year of the Villain one-shot is scheduled for May 1st, just 4 days before Free Comic Book Day. Year of the Villain also, we found a little bit more information since this article was published about kind of what it entails, thanks to Bendis. We're going to get the launch of the Leviathan, basically, is going to this new eight organization that Bendis has introduced is going to dominate, basically, and defeat the Man of Steel, Superman, and put him in a bad way. Batman's going to be in a bad way with the Bane stuff going on. The Batman Who Laughs or whatever is going to have his little deal going on where he's doing his doohickey. And in Justice League, we're going to see Lex Luthor's Legion of Doom band together with these cosmic gods to gain some control. What are your thoughts on this initiative, Nick?
Yeah. You know, my enthusiasm.
On the one hand, I know it's comics and it's cyclical, but it doesn't feel like that long ago. Maybe it was that long ago. Maybe it's probably been 5 years now. I think about it, 5 or 6 years, but it doesn't feel to me like that long ago that we had, Villains Month and Forever Evil. Remember that whole deal?
Yeah, that would have been during
all the villains got a one shot.
Would have been during the New 52. So
yeah, so 2012 or 13, something like that. And all the villains got a one shot in a month, and it was all part of Forever Evil, which was this long event that sort of later led to Darkseid War, which was a great event. I loved that event, but it does feel a little bit like been there, done that to me. Because one of the other things that I read about the series is on this day our heroes will lose. And I'm like, haven't we kind of seen that a lot in DC? but at the same time, what a great creative team this has got. I mean, all these creators, great creators involved. I'm pretty excited about the Superman storyline, which I haven't been reading, obviously, but I think it sounds intriguing. And the Batman stuff, I mean, at this point, you know, everybody out there knows how I feel about Batman right now in the DC universe, and that I'm not really on board with most of what they're doing with him right now. But that being said, I know a lot of people are on board with all of what they're doing with him right now. And so for them, I'm sure this is an exciting announcement.
Yeah.
That's all you got?
I mean, you're giving me? You know, it's not by accident. I mean, it is by accident that I've built up this massive stack of monthly comics, but it's not without reason. Like, my enthusiasm to pick them up and read them is lower than it's been in quite some time, and I would argue that it's largely because of the abandonment of DC's ideas and lessons that it had theoretically learned and put into place during the Rebirth Initiative. And the further we move away from that, the less interested I become. And this all sounds like a bunch of shit I don't care about, whether it be the Batman Who Laughs, or I still haven't – I am one of the world's biggest Brian Michael Bendis fans, and I still haven't read any of his DC work, which should say something about both me and about my excitement for his work on Superman. I have not yet read any of Scott Snyder's Justice League, but the things that I have heard – do not exactly fill me with excitement for the book. I am looking forward to one day catching up on Tom King's Batman and seeing how that all plays out.
Well, I think we both need to give Bendis' Superman a shot at some point, right. Perhaps through the app or something, because I have heard good things about it, but there have been a couple of things that have irked me, like the aging up of John Kent I don't like, but that being said, I've heard so many good things about it from so many different people about how well he's written Lois and how well he's written Clark that I'm interested in checking it out. So I think there's potential here for story. Mm-hmm. Another thing that DC – but I think to your point, to your greater point, it does feel like a complete reversal of Rebirth at this point. Rebirth was all about restoring hope and, you know, light to the DC universe. And this feels like the last year to year and a half, Nick, has felt like it was about beating all of that light back out and putting us right back where we were before. We like stories, both of us, as much as I egg him on about this. We both enjoy stories where our heroes go through pain and suffering, right?
Mm-hmm.
But there's a point of overdoing it too. And there's a point of homogeny.
I also like good stories where our heroes go through pain and suffering.
Yes.
And I would argue relatively few of those going on right now.
Which I guess one could argue that we're in no place to say since we're not reading them, but based on the directions we can say, the directions they're going in are not.
We're not reading them without reason. Like, if we were
right,
if there were anything in comics right now that had me so excited that I had to run out and get it and read it immediately, I would do that. But there isn't, so I'm not.
Right. Exactly. Well, speaking of dark and depraved, we're going to get a standalone alternate universe story coming soon called Deceased. Written by Tom Taylor, who was well known for his alternate universe stories Injustice. And he, along with artists Trevor Hairsign, Stefan Guadiano, James Heron, and Rain Barreto, will be launching a is this a series or a mini series? I'm trying to track that down in this article, and
I'm sure it's a mini series.
They're not doing a good job of explaining it. But the premise of it is that there is this cosmic virus of sorts that's unleashed by Darkseid and even affects Darkseid. And it basically turns much of the DC universe into zombie-like creatures. It's like a rage virus of sorts. And Batman has no idea how to combat this. And it's basically how our heroes react to the world turning into this madness and how each of them reacts to it. And even Darkseid himself being affected by it. So, you know, I'm not going to criticize this at all, Nick. I think this is fine. Maybe it will be something that's up my alley. I don't know.
Right.
It's an alternate universe tale. It's an Elseworlds, essentially. And I'm all for that. I heard good things about Tom Taylor's Injustice. I liked what I read of his Injustice. So
And I did like the, there's this one page of Darkseid almost clawing his own skin off. And I thought that was really, really cool. So this could be good. What do you think?
It might be good, but it does not sound like anything I'm interested in. It sounds like a decade too late answer to Marvel Zombies, which wasn't that great to begin with. So
that's fair. Yeah, I'm probably not going to read it either. I was trying to build it up a little bit and be fair, but I'm not going to read it either. But that being said, I do like Tom Taylor. And
yeah, I like what I've read of his as well. This just conceptually does nothing.
I like that this is an Elseworlds rather than in continuity, because I've read stories about technoviruses since I was a kid, and I don't think I've ever liked any of them. So, and that includes the Batman story, Contagion. Anyway, now on to a very exciting announcement. Legitimately exciting announcement. Nick, are you ready? DC is launching...
Well, half of an exciting announcement.
Well, we gotta should throw a bone to our good buddy David Sunday here. Host of...
Must we?
The host of...
Easy Like David Sunday?
The Sunday Groove. Easy Like David Sunday, if you prefer.
I do.
Because DC is, not are, launching two new Superman family titles. I'm going to start with the David Sunday influenced one. Jimmy Olsen by writer Matt Fraction and artist Steve Lieber, which I could be wrong, but I believe this might be Matt Fraction's very first ongoing DC work. And it's a Jimmy Olsen series about Superman's pal, notably not a James Olsen series.
Oh, man.
And, you know, here's the thing about this. David Sunday is giddy about this. And I know you are not. However, Matt Fraction wrote a compelling Hawkeye series, which I think says a lot. If he can turn Hawkeye into an interesting character, I believe he can do that with Jimmy Olsen. But
at least Hawkeye does something.
But in the Hawkeye comic, does he though? He goes and buys pizza.
Right, yes, but like...
And runs afoul of the mob.
He runs afoul of the mob and then is able to take action to combat the mob, to, you know, have a means to resolve the conflict with the mob. What the hell is Jimmy Olsen going to do?
You're showing a disturbing lack of respect for the great photojournalists out there. Photojournalists like Thomas Groening.
Oh, for fun. I see what you did there. What's he going to do? Like, sit in a dark room? Like, what the fuck is this? And yes, I am fully aware of the fact that DC for years published a Superman's pal Jimmy Olsen comic.
That's like, right.
I have never understood the appeal of Jimmy Olsen-focused solo stories.
We're just going to have to see, Nick. We're just going to have to see.
You say that, and you're not going to read a word of it.
And you know I might when it and goes you know to trade it. On DC
you're gonna,
Universe.
You're going to make me sound like the bad guy for not wanting to read a fucking Jimmy Olsen book, and you're not going to spend trade. 1 second of your life turning a digital page of any fucking Jimmy Olsen book.
When we do a long book on it, I will. We might have to do that thing
you do where you make me sound like, oh, I'm being negative and I'm being the one who hates everything, when the fact of the matter is you're just as guilty as I am in this instance. You just won't come out and say it.
You're making a lot of assumptions.
You don't have any interest in reading a Jimmy Olsen book. Say it.
You're making a lot.
Do you have any interest in reading a Jimmy Olsen book?
What? Give me the story. What's the story?
The story is that Matt Fraction and this other fucker are writing a Jimmy Olsen book.
No comment.
I rest my case.
No comment. No. You can't rest your case.
Your silence speaks volumes.
I'm not even going to dignify with the response. What I am going to dignify is the more exciting announcement.
As long as you're dignifying this book in the privacy of your own home, please.
The very exciting announcement, and I'll be dignifying it a lot in my home, sometimes twice or three times a night.
Well.
And it's...
beware of chafing.
It's... writer Greg Rucka, a favorite of the Hard Traveling Fanboys.
Yes.
Along with artist Mike Poikins, Perkins,
sure,
normal people that aren't Vince Russo. They are launching a brand new title called Lois Lane. This
now,
is
what
the most exciting announcement that DC's had in a long time for me.
And you may be saying to yourself, oh, if a Jimmy Olsen book isn't interesting, why would a Lois Lane book be interesting? Because actual investigative journalism is more interesting than photojournalism. Not to mention the fact that not to mention the fact that Lois Lane, throughout the history of her character, has been portrayed as an aggressive, independent character and not a whiny, nerdy little bitch. And so that, in and of itself, plus the Greg Rucka of it all, makes for an infinitely more interesting ongoing series than Jimmy fucking Olsen.
Now, Jimmy fucking Olsen could be a fun series in and of itself.
Well, which Olsen is he fucking? Mary Kate? Ashley? Elizabeth?
Elizabeth. Definitely Elizabeth.
Now, yeah, that's what you want to see, Greg? Somebody else going where you dream of going?
Hey, you know what? You have to be realistic in life, Nick.
That's true. You live vicariously.
But no, this Lois Lane series sounds amazing. I've made no secret on the show. She's my favorite woman in all of comics. Mm-hmm. Has been since I was a little kid. My favorite female character in comics. And is just a dynamic personality. And one of the only writers that I would have a ton of faith writing her on an ongoing is Greg Rucka.
Greg Rucka,
yeah. I would have been happy with a Brian Michael Bendis.
I was about to say, Bendis would have killed it as well.
Yes, Bendis and Rucka are two of those people on that short list that I would definitely read an ongoing Lois series from. And I'm all in on this. I may not read it. I may not ever pick it. I may not ever have time to actually read it, but I will add it to a pull list and I will buy it just to support the book.
There you go.
And I plan on reading it because I'm very excited about it.
So are you also going to do that for the Jimmy Olsen title?
No.
Okay.
No, I'm not.
Okay.
No, I'm not. But I'm not an anti-Jimmite like you.
Oh, my God. Here we go. You can't own up to something.
I've got nothing against Jimmy Olsen.
I have nothing against Jimmy Olsen as a supporting character in another book featuring a more interesting character than Jimmy Olsen. I have no interest in reading 32 fucking pages of Jimmy Olsen running around doing nothing.
I know what this is. You're upset because they're not making it about suave millionaire CEO James Olsen. That's what your problem is.
No. My problem is that Jimmy Olsen's a lame character.
Oh, that's not true. Jimmy Olsen's not a lame character. I would argue that Jimmy Olsen as a lead character arguably is lame.
Arguably.
Jimmy Olsen himself is not a lame character.
Okay, fine. Jimmy Olsen, when he knows his role and he shuts the mouth, is fine. But Jimmy Olsen trying to step up and be front and center, not my thing, man.
Well, one thing that wasn't DC's thing was the story Second Coming over in Vertigo.
Oh, boy.
And I would tell you more about this if I could find the article and open it up, which I am currently attempting and failing to do because it won't. There it is. The article says here that DC's has informed retailers that the upcoming Vertigo series, Second Coming, by
Mark Russell. And Richard Pace.
Has been canceled, and that, quote, these issues will not be resolicited. The publisher did not share the reason for the decision at that time. Since then, a related story indicates that the writer, Mark Russell, has said that DC editorial changes led to his decision to jump to another publisher and request full rights to the book back, which I think he has been granted.
He has, yes.
Russell said that DC requested the removal of some profanity and covering up male nudity in a Garden of Eden scene, along with additional changes. They also got negative attention from a Fox News report.
Oh, for God's sake.
And subsequent petition for the book's cancellation that may have indirectly contributed to DC's plan for the story. However, the changes were requested before the Fox News story, and he went elsewhere. There's a lot of different factors in on this, Nick. Mm-hmm. The first factor I would point to is the continuing DC I guess you would say censorship of supposedly mature rated titles.
Yeah, I think
I think is a bigger issue than some of the other stuff.
In a shorter term, from a short term view, this kind of stems back to the Batman Damned controversy, the Bat Damned controversy. Where, I mean, we talked about months ago on the show DC's wide reaching plans for not just re-emphasizing the rejuvenating the Vertigo line, but also introducing the DC Black Label line, which was going to be a series of adult-themed takes on classic DC concepts. To date, Batman Damned is the only of those projects that has actually seen the light of day, and if you believe the internet rumor and innuendo, all other Black Label projects, with the exception of Greg Capullo and Scott Snyder's Batman Last Night on Earth, are all going to be canceled ultimately. Or if they do release, they won't be released under the Black Label line, because the Black Label line, as a result of Batman Damned, is gone the way of all things.
Except for the Snyder and Capullo thing.
Except for the Snyder and Capullo thing, that's it. And then they will also apparently retain Black Label as something to publish existing adult material under, something like Watchmen or Dark Knight Returns, but in terms of...
Makes you wonder, will they then go in and censor the existing content?
You have no clue.
Taking out the Wangs from Watchmen, for instance.
But to me, if you're going to censor Vertigo titles, just go ahead and shut Vertigo down as an imprint.
Absolutely. Like, 100%.
And I'm not, and
there's
I am no not,
point to it.
I am not saying that a writer should be able to write whatever they want without impunity and there is no editorial oversight whatsoever. I'm not saying that. I'm saying there is a level of reasonable editorial oversight, and then there is wanting to alter profanity, and I cannot imagine that Mark Russell was depicting characters in the Garden of Eden with their ass cheeks spread open or something. There was probably some incidental frontal nudity that would occur, by the way, in the fucking Garden of Eden before when you had the innocence of man and they didn't know that, you know, they needed to clothe to avoid being improper. It was service of the story.
Which has been illustrated in paintings since, you know, the turn of the birth of Christ, you know?
This particular decision by DC makes it readily apparent that Vertigo serves no purpose in the modern context. Image has become what Vertigo used to be. And we kind of have all known that for quite some time. It has filled the role that Vertigo used to fill. And it's sad to say, but there is zero chance that one of our favorite books of all time, Preacher, would ever be allowed to be published by DC Comics in 2019.
Right. No chance.
And we're supposed to be making progress in theory as we go forward throughout history, not regressing. And when it comes to DC Comics publishing, you know, viewpoints, it feels like we are regressing, and that is frustrating.
Because they would have caved, because it would have been whether it would have been the conservative crowd upset about the nudity, whether it would have been other crowds upset about the
sexual content. Yep.
They would have caved to that instantly, and we would have never gotten the product that we got. So I totally agree with that. And I wasn't actually going to read Second Coming. I didn't really have much interest in it, but
it sounded awesome to me. Like, no, I'm not even gonna
lie. A lot of people were interested in it. Yes. And I think DC, their hair trigger finger, which they've had, not just DC, I don't mean to limit it to DC, but also Warner Brothers, their hair trigger finger from a corporate level has once again cost them a potential winner in this case.
Now let me say this and give them a little props, though. Oftentimes, if DC cared to, they could have tied this book up in legal wranglings for years. But whoever made the call on the DC side, and I've seen some reporting that it may have actually been, you know, and I'm critical of the guy all the time, but it may have actually been Dan DiDio himself who made the call to release the rights back to Mark Russell. If that's the case, good on DC. Because I don't think there's any question. I would not, you know, we'll never know what the hypothetical sales figures would have been for this book at Vertigo, but I bet you they are going to be higher now than they were before. Because of the controversy and the idea that any publicity is good publicity.
Yes, the controversy absolutely will help the book sales-wise, I think. Assuming it gets good distribution, if we're assuming it lands at Image or something like that.
Yeah, I mean,
that.
An Image or a You know, I don't. Valiant is more concerned with his own, you know, in-universe stuff at the moment. But there are numerous outlets for it. Is my point. And Image right. seems to be the logical landing spot. So we'll see.
But nonetheless, that sort of wraps up our rundown. I think that's all the big news and notes items in the world of comics and really in the world of pop culture. I can't think of anything else of note happening.
No exciting news about, you know, acclaimed producers and production companies working with acclaimed actors to take on acclaimed professional wrestlers.
You're right. Actually, there is a news story about that, which doesn't really tie into comics, but you know, the movie Fighting With My Family mm-hmm. is sitting at, I think, 93% on Rotten Tomatoes right now, mm-hmm. produced by The Rock, about the life of wrestler Paige,
and directed by
Stephen Merchant. And
that's it's a nice little film, you know. It's done. It's put together by some good little hands. And I'm sure that a couple of years from now, when there's another film that's ranking at 103% on the tomato meter, you know, we'll talk about that when that time comes.
Perhaps we will, Nick. Perhaps we will. But for now, let's end the rundown and let's move over to a segment where we like to tell you all what we've been reading and what we've been watching. It's a segment that we call Reading and Watching. What you been reading and watching? Have you been reading anything, Nick?
No.
Nor have
actually,
I.
That's not true.
You've been reading WWE.
Actually, I read some of the other WWE comics that were on Hoopla because I was curious.
Oh, tell us.
Yeah, so WWE, one of the things we ran into was, when I did the search for WWE on Hoopla when we first decided to do this, there were multiple trade editions. There was both volumes of something called WWE, and then there was volumes of something called WWE Then, Now, Forever. To add to that confusion, the first volume of WWE included the first issue of WWE Then, Now, Forever. So I decided to kind of do some research and see what this was all about. And I wound up reading an entire trade volume of WWE Then, Now, Forever. And what it is, apparently, is a series of – it's an anthology book, essentially, that takes a look back through WWE history at various events, whether they happened at SummerSlam or WrestleMania or what have you, told through the eyes of various WWE superstars throughout the past. And then also just some stories that just – feature wild out there incarnations of WWE characters, whether it be the New Day literally traveling through time or the Ultimate Warrior climbing mountains to confront the gods who bestow powers upon him, or I'm trying to think of others. Shawn Michaels and Razor Ramon in the ladder match rematch, both contemplating how angry Bret Hart's going to be at them for using the ladder as a weapon during the match. Just different stuff from throughout wrestling history. Pretty interesting. I enjoyed it.
Very good to hear. And that actually reminded me, Nick, in addition to me wanting to read some of that, I didn't talk about my favorite part of the WWE trade in the first half of the show, which was the photo or the cover gallery included in the back of the trade. This is outstanding. There are some of these images, some of these covers I would like to get blown up and get them as posters, Nick. I'm looking through the gallery right now. It's a pretty massive gallery, actually. There's like 30 pages of covers here. One by Frazier Irving of The Undertaker stands out. Dan Morris, Sasha Banks stands out. Let's see. What else we got? Oh, the Razor Ramon one by Jamal Campbell is awesome with the Vice City style pastels in the background. Razor sitting on his car with the Intercontinental Championship. That one's awesome. Oliver Barrett with Macho Man might be my favorite one because he illustrated Macho biting his bottom lip, which was, of course, one of his, you know, trademark facial tics. And there's a cover where Daniel Bryan is wrestling a bear, which is a nice in-joke. Finn Balor by Corbin Kern. Oliver Barrett's Finn Balor is awesome. These are just outstanding covers. I would recommend if you guys can find this gallery online anywhere, check this out, because there's some outstanding artwork if you're a wrestling fan. A great Shawn Michaels cover by Alexander Wells. Shinsuke by Robbie Rodriguez. Of course, the greatest wrestler of all time, Bret Hart by Robert Samelin, which I would like to get as a poster. I mean, there's just all, outstanding Ric Flair one who I should mention. Gosh, Nick, this past weekend. Well, we'll get to that at the end of the show in the wrestling minute. But for now, reading and watching, I'm not reading anything. So let's move on to watching. Well, last week we had, I believe we had Supergirl, but I haven't watched it. So, Nick, what happened on Supergirl?
We had the villain Menagerie make her debut and continued conflict between Kara, or internal conflict for Kara as she has to deal with the idea that Alex no longer retains her memories of them working together as Supergirl and Alex in her capacity as, at the DEO. We get some advancement of the Jimmy and the James and Lena stuff, and some a little bit of advancement on the Agent Liberty stuff. So without spoilers, solid episode of Supergirl.
Outstanding. Well, let's move on to Arrow. Monday night, of course, brought us a brand new episode of Arrow, and a very different episode of Arrow, Nick. I think this was almost more of a horror-themed episode of Arrow, in which we have the resolution to a mini arc they've been telling with a killer who is targeting Team Arrow, sending them messages saying that he can get to them at any time. He's also killing people around town that seemingly have no relation to one another. And William has, of course, returned to town as of the previous episode and is basically acting like a little shit. And he's upset. He got expelled from his school. He's mad at Oliver. He's mad at Felicity. He won't listen to him. He wants to at one point in the episode, he calls his grandparents behind their backs because he wants to move in with his grandparents to have a normal life. And which I think is understandable. But I got to admit, during this episode, I kind of wanted Oliver to backhand him a couple times.
Yes.
Well,
you sent me to boarding school. You kept a mob boss from murdering me for an entire year.
Yeah.
Why?
Oh, you've protected me countless times. Oh, wah.
Oh, but somebody killed my mother to get to you.
Now wait just a minute. Let's not validate his concerns.
His bitchy whining.
He may have some reasons, but still. Respect your elders, kid, says young Greg Phillips in the early 90s when he's watching Home Alone. The crux of this episode, though, was the
return. No wonder you were a Superman fan when you were a kid.
The crux of this episode, though, is the return of Oliver's, quote, friend from prison that you might remember from the beginning of the season. I forget his name, Nick, for the life of me. Stanley Dover, yes. Who is outstanding, by the way. We loved his character arc. If you remember at the beginning of the season in Slabside, we thought that was brilliantly done.
We hated him at first, and then we liked him.
Yes, and it ended up being a great story arc told with him. There. Well, here is the payoff to it, where he comes back, and he comes back in a big, bad way. This was a genuinely frightening episode at times, including one of the most convincing near deaths they've ever done for a character, in my opinion, on the show. I was convinced that one of the characters was dying in this episode when it happened, and I was genuinely shocked when it happened. And this actor that plays Stanley gave a probably as good a one-off villain performance as I've ever seen on Arrow in all the seasons of watching it. As far as like one of the villain of the week episodes, I can't remember a better performance than this. He was terrifying and convincing and riveting. And the scene where, in particular, where Felicity, Oliver, and William have been paralyzed at the table is so good. Mm-hmm. I thought this was a great episode, man. I thought this had everything that you look for from Arrow. It had drama. It had intrigue. It had some funny bits thrown in there.
I would argue it had probably some of the more interesting flash forwards that we've seen in a while. Where
yes.
It finally felt like the momentum was starting to pick back up on that front, where they've kind of been spinning their wheels for a while.
Absolutely. And spoiler alert, spoiler alert, spoiler alert. Everybody, this is a spoiler alert. If you want to fast forward about maybe 5 to 10 minutes, do that. This episode also did two amazing things, Nick. Number one, strengthened, not weakened, Olicity. mm-hmm. against our concerns, because she gets the phone call in this one that she is.
Did it strengthen it or did it weaken it?
Well, we don't know.
Because remember, go ahead. Go ahead.
Well, she gets a call that she is preggers, as the kids mm-hmm. say. Mm-hmm. And in the flash forward, we find out that it's been her daughter who has been running around in the future. Her as daughter.
Blackheart, yeah. Or Blackheart. Black Star,
yeah. Mia Smoke.
Smoke.
Which, of course, is a nod to Mia Dearden in the comics.
But it's interesting that she has taken for her name Mia Smoke, not Mia
Queen.
Even though she refers to herself, specifically says that she is Future William's brother. So.
No, she's Future William's sister.
Sister, yeah, whatever. You know what I mean. Now, wait a minute. That would be a twist. But so the question becomes, is Alicity strengthened? I don't know. I think
we don't know. It's compelling.
Yep.
It's compelling to watch. And we also find out that her friend that she's running around with in the future that we saw at the end of the last episode is Connor Hawk.
Yes.
The son of John Diggle. Why he's Connor Hawk and not Connor Diggle, we don't know.
Yes. That happened. Remember, that's a callback to that Legends of Tomorrow episode from season mm-hmm. one of Legends of Tomorrow, where they visited Star City in like 2046 or something like that. So all kinds of interesting stuff in this episode. I enjoyed it.
And we're not even talking about the most exciting thing that happened on the episode. Curtis is gone, finally.
Well.
Yes.
Bye.
I love it. Curtis has moved off, and it is no longer going to be haunting my watchings of Arrow. Now, Nick, if they could just slowly wither away the rest of New Team Arrow, mm-hmm. we'll be walking in high cotton.
Old times there, even not forgotten.
That's right. Even though I like Renee, I would be willing to lose Renee if it meant losing all the New Team Arrow stuff and just focusing on Oliver and the rest. But what did you think of this episode, Nick? I love this episode.
I am hesitantly optimistic that perhaps losing Curtis will be enough. Like,
yeah,
Dinah
right.
has had her high moments, and
mm-hmm.
and
that's true.
Renee has been steadily improving, so you know maybe this is enough. Maybe this is what we needed.
What did you think of the ep?
Oh, I enjoyed it very much. I mean, you said it perfect. Not really much more to add than that.
So Tuesday night gives us another new episode of The Flash, mm-hmm. and in this particular episode,
it is really sad at this point, Greg. Like it went from being a joke to becoming like frustrating to now it's like it is genuinely depressing how mediocre this season of The Flash is, despite some of the best scenes the show's ever done. Like,
yeah,
it has outstanding scenes in almost every episode that are dragged down by a fucking Roy Nelson like weight that is Cicada. Like, I mean, how you gonna get the moon off you? Like it, I. Oh.
Are you referring to the weight that is Chris Klein and his performance as Cicada?
Yes. The writing of that character, the performance of that character, everything about Cicada sucks more than anything The Flash has ever done.
Cicada, yes, I agree.
Cicada sucks more than the Bug-Eyed Bandit.
Yes, because the Bug-Eyed Bandit was only around for one episode. Cicada continues to come back every single week and give us shitty performance after shitty performance after terribly written performance. And just no. There's nothing redeeming about this character. There's nothing redeeming about his story.
But all the other stuff is really good.
Yeah, yeah. So the crux of this episode was Nora going back Barry goes into the Speed Force for plot, you know, sledgehammer of plot related reasons and to age up this formula, and leaves Nora on her own basically to command Team Flash. And Nora, in her attempt to stop Cicada from killing her mom, ends up getting, I forget who the first one was killed, someone killed, and she goes back in time, which we've learned on The Flash is a terrible idea. And she goes back in time 52 times in attempts to change the timeline, failing each time. And it sets up the crux of this episode, which is that Nora has to accept failure and accept help from the rest of the team in order to figure out how to avoid the inevitable future that at least one of them will die. So we also get a lecture from Barry about the importance of not time traveling and how there's ripple effects. I'm giving them the benefit of the doubt, Nick, that they will actually explore some of the effects of Nora's 52 trips through the time stream.
Yes, I would think so at some point.
Yes. If they don't follow through on that, I'm going to end up retroactively hating this episode. But as it was, I liked the episode. I'll be honest with you. I'm becoming not a big fan of the Nora character because I feel like they're telling the same stories with her every week, which is she does something stupid every week. And I'm kind of over it at this point. I feel like, you know, at a certain point, the character should have matured by now and should have started making some mature decisions besides constantly screwing up and whining about it. But that being said, I did enjoy this episode. I'm a sucker for that kind of format where you go back and relive the same events. So I kind of enjoyed the episode overall, but God, the cicada stuff was terrible. And I can only hope that it's coming to an end soon because it does look like Thawne is we're starting to get increasingly worried about, though, Nick, is that Thawne's going to be the villain for next season.
Yes, that is a concern I have as well.
But and not this season.
We'll have to wait and see what happens, I guess.
So anyway, time to rank them. You've got three to rank. I've got two. I will go Arrow by far this week and then Flash at number two.
I'll go Arrow, Supergirl, Flash.
Very good. Well, with that said, I look over at the recently embedded digital grandfather clock on the wall here in the studio, and I can tell that there's a minute on the clock, and Nick, it's time for the wrestling minute.
Oh, is it ever?
And there's a lot going on in the wrestling world.
We've had a huge
week of WWE television with a pay-per-view, the Elimination Chamber, I thought was –
no,
pretty sorry overall.
Cares.
And ultimately, the main event was excellent. The rise of Kofi, hashtag Kofi Mania, as a trend.
Nope.
And I thought it was an excellent SmackDown.
Nope.
And a moderate Raw that featured the debut of several NXT talents, Nick. Mm-hmm.
Are you done talking about all that irrelevant stuff? You done with that?
Yes. Yes.
Let's talk about the greatest announcement in the history of sports and entertainment and sports entertainment and human history.
You left out just entertainment and just sports.
I said sports and entertainment and sports entertainment. Don't do that. When news broke this week, today actually, that I don't even know. It brings me such utter joy to say these words. The Hollywood Reporter is exclusively reporting from Hollywood.
The Hollywood Hogan Reporter.
That a deal is in place for Hangover director Todd Phillips.
God, spit it out already.
Todd Phillips, along with production companies that involve such names as Bradley Cooper are going to take one of the greatest stories in our species' history and adapt it to the silver screen. You see, folks, coming soon to a streaming device or possibly a theater near you, this is the life story of Hulk Hogan is being brought to us. And who could play such a man as Hulk Hogan? Why only, Greg, the world's sexiest man, Chris Hemsworth? This is the greatest thing I have ever heard. I can't wait.
And, Nick, is there any truth to the rumors that the working title is Orange is the New Black?
Is there any truth to the idea, to the rumor, Greg, that announcement of this set off a wave of jealousy from bitter people such as you and Todd Weber making lame jokes in an attempt to bring down my happiness? I eagerly await, by the way, the long, overly serious, boring Bret Hart biopic or the whoever the fuck Todd Weber cares about biopic. No, they're not going to be made. They're not going to be made. You know why? Because your favorite wrestlers aren't relevant. They're not box office, and Hulk Hogan is box office.
Well, just so long as it's not a box office aimed at anyone who isn't white, right?
Oh, there it is. There it is. That you try as you might, Greg. Try as you might, you're not going to bring me down on this day. You're going to eagerly anticipate this movie just the same way I am, and it's going to be awesome.
I have another question, too, about this project. Do you think that Hemsworth is going to embrace the Hulk Hogan haircut, or will he have to get some sort of hairpiece?
I'm thinking he'll embrace the facial hair, but he'll have to do a hairpiece from the top. Although, screw it. Why not just give Hogan a full head of hair? I don't care.
Hey, Hulk, you didn't mention that Hulk is going to be an advisor on the film.
Both Hogan and Eric Bischoff are going to be yes. Executive producers and advisors on the film. Okay, in all seriousness, correct me if I'm wrong. Was there not a rumor that exactly this was going to happen like 4 years ago at some point?
Yes.
Do you remember that? There was like the rumor that Chris Hemsworth was going to do this Hulk Hogan biopic.
And we all laughed it off.
We thought it was insane.
Now it's happening. Now, what do you make of people now speculating that since Bradley Cooper is producing this, this is going to be the same film in which we were going to get Bradley Cooper as Vince McMahon?
Or
what about my idea?
Yes.
Where they're parts of the same universe and they tie together.
The WWE Cinematic Universe.
Universe, yes.
Because that would be awesome, in all honesty. Like, have Bradley Cooper's Vince as kind of the Nick Fury that, like, floats between all these movies.
WWE Avengers.
Yes. And you got like a Hogan movie. You get a Savage movie. You get a pipe. Like, that would be awesome.
Picture this. The Hogan movie ends as Hogan walks into a bar at the end of the movie. And you see Bradley Cooper's Vince sitting in the bar, legs up on the table, drinking a protein shake, of course, instead of smoking a cigar. Hogan sits down and Vince says, "Pal, I'm putting together a team if you're interested." And then Hogan starts stroking his Fu Manchu.
Yes. I'm for all of this. In all seriousness, like, I have so many questions about, like, the initial report says they're only going to tell a portion of his life story, that seemingly it's going to be a, quote, origin story about the rise of Hulkamania. So, like, where does that cut off? Like, what is the narrative of the film? I think
you have to cut it off at WrestleMania 3 if that's the story.
And see, a lot of people are thinking you cut it off at the Garden in 84. So, like, if that's the case, like, it really is interesting. Like, the fact that this is even going to exist, because you're going to have to depict things that have never really been depicted before. Like, Vince McMahon has been depicted, like, in that terrible Jesse Ventura biopic or whatever. But, like, getting into, like, Vince Sr. or Vern Gagne or, like, all this other stuff that...
Hiro Matsuda.
Oh, Hiro Matsuda. Yes, that's going to be awesome. I hope Hiro Matsuda... Hiro Matsuda, as Hogan tells the story, has to essentially be a blatantly offensive Asian stereotype in the film. Like, with, like, a Fu Manchu mustache and a top knot. And he breaks Hogan's leg and, like, says something in Mandarin or whatever. Like... This sounds awesome, dude. I can't. I literally can't wait for this.
The other thing about if we do have a WWE Cinematic Universe, what's going to be interesting is that presumably Hulk is an advisor on this movie. And if the Vince movie happens, you have to imagine that Vince would have some say in it. These versions of reality will not match up at all.
No. And like,
they're going to be two wildly different, equally exaggerated stories.
Right. And that's the thing. I mean, all biopics are exaggerated. Like, there's not.
Oh, absolutely.
There is no biopic. People are already taking those shots. Oh, that'll be real accurate. What are we going to watch, a documentary? Or are we going to watch a fucking movie? Like, make up your mind. No one is going to rain on my parade today. This sounds awesome. They need to Marvel should immediately release Chris Hemsworth from all promotional obligations for Avengers Endgame so that they can start filming tomorrow. I need casting announcements. There are just so
many. We've already gotten word that the Vince movie will reportedly have a very young, attractive Linda McMahon who raves about Vince's sexual appetites.
Yes.
What do you think the Hogan movie is going to do with Linda?
Oh, Tim Capel had a great suggestion of Margot Robbie as Linda Balea. That would be awesome. And then just digitally take her face and put it on a baby for whatever Brooke is doing. And in all seriousness, if this does well, and the fact they're cutting it off early in his career, you could make a trilogy of this. This is awesome. Hogan has had like seven false finishes to his career. What, you could make it seem like it was the end of his career in like every movie.
Wait a minute. I'm getting the Ho Ho Loon ticker is oddly activating, but it's not Ho Ho Loon related. I don't understand. Oh. I'm getting a message from one of our listeners here.
Oh God.
It says here that it's from a Lee Wes.
Oh boy.
And he says that the idea of a Hulk Hogan or Vince McMahon biopic happening before we even get a movie about the Gold Dust Trio or about Frank Gotch and George Hackenschmidt's second encounter is an affront to me and an affront to humanity. Mm. Your thoughts on this?
I have no thoughts other than pro wrestling was made inarguably better in January of 1984, and we should ignore everything that came before.
Well, speaking of pro wrestling, Nick, while we're still on the wrestling, what's turned into half hour, I had a wrestling experience of my own over the weekend, you might know.
Yes.
In fact, you do know. The listeners might know. I, alongside a fellow Place to Be Nation Pop member, Jennifer Smith, attended – at the luxurious Center Stage Alabama, a one-man show presented by the Nature Boy Ric Flair. Sorry, that was a weird way of saying that. The Nature Boy Ric Flair and hosted by the Mouth of the South, Jimmy Hart. Kind of an intimate theater experience, about 300 people there, I think, in that theater. And we went there on Saturday night and had a great time. The Nature Boy was in classic podcast Ric Flair form, where he's all over the place. Poor Jimmy Hart would ask questions that would never get answered, but we'd instead get answers to questions that we never had. And it was fantastic. It was absolutely hilarious. Flair was incredibly charismatic. He was telling great stories. He was giggling the whole time and saying things he wasn't supposed to say. It was supposed to be a sort of family-friendly environment. Luckily, there were no kids there. Everybody kind of knew what it was going to be. And he would just let fly with the stories of debauchery and stories of bowel movements and stories of all kinds of great things. It was awesome, Nick. You would have loved it.
I'm glad to hear that. That is very, very exciting. Well, yep. We went a little over on the wrestling minute this week. Our apologies, folks. But, as we've been doing every week here for some time, we're going to close the show with a little musical exit from our good friend WWE Hall of Famer Jim Ross. And I mean, given the momentous announcement today, inarguably one of the greatest announcements in the history of our species, I can think personally of no better way to end this show but by having Hall of Famer Jim Ross give his own personal take on not just one of the greatest wrestling theme songs of all time, but one of the greatest musical compositions across time and space. Here to do for you his rendition of Hulk Hogan's classic entrance theme, Real American. Ladies and gentlemen, Jim Ross.
Hi there, folks. Good old JR here. And before we get started this week, I would like to tell you what's been on my mind. Now, for many, many years, really dating back to my career with Ted Turner's company, WCW, people have been accusing me of having an anti-Hulk Hogan bias or some sort of sentiments against Hulk, and that's just not true. Now, granted, there have been times when I've written things or said things about Hulk Hogan that were maybe not the most positive things in the world, times where I might have criticized his in-ring work rate, times where I might have criticized some of the things that he's done outside the ring, but But all that, none of that should matter, because ultimately, I am a fan of Hulk Hogan. I am a fan of Hulkamania, and I am a believer in second chances. So, folks, I just want to sing this song and dedicate it to my good friend Terry Bollea, a man whom I've always had respect for, a man whom, despite what certain Richards on the internet might try to dig up, I have always been friends with. Ladies and gentlemen, Real American. Doot, 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 doot. When it comes crashing down and it hurts inside. Well, or quite frankly, what if it's busted inside? Who the hell knows what happens? Colonel Robert Parker has something busted inside. I saw it. Anyway, you got to take a stand. It doesn't hurt to hide. If you hurt my friends and you hurt my pride, I've got to be a man. I can't let it slide, for God's sake. Now, me, folks, I am a real American. I fight for the rights of every man and woman, quite frankly. It is 2019. I am a real American. Fight for what's right. Fight for your by God life. Now, folks, I feel strong about right and wrong. Maybe you don't. And that is your prerogative. If you don't feel strong about right or wrong, that's your right. You don't have to. You can be right there in the middle. Sometimes the truth is right in the middle. There is no right or wrong. Then again, sometimes there is a right and wrong. And in that case, you need to feel strong one way or the other. Listen, folks, it's very simple what I'm trying to tell you right now. Either you should feel strong about right and wrong, or you shouldn't. It's very simple. Anyway, that being said, I don't take trouble for very long. I've got something deep inside of me. It's a hemorrhoid, quite frankly. And courage is the only thing that will set it free. Well, courage and a little bit of that preparation H. I am a real American. Fight for the rights of most every man. I am a real American. Fight for what's right. Fight for your by God life. I am a real American. Fight for the rights of every man. Now, in case you haven't heard it the first few times, folks, I'm a real American. Fight for what's right. Fight for your life. Now, if you hurt my friends, well, then you hurt my pride. I have to be a man. I cannot let it slide. I'm a real American. Fight for the rights of every man. I am a real American. Fight for what's right. Fight for your by God life.
Hard traveling fanboys.